Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Stand, Episode 1, The End, has reached its end, and chronicling the end of civilization as well, but we are just getting started here on post-show recaps, and boy, let me tell you guys, there's going to be a lot to say, maybe 1,400 unedited pages worth of things to say about this particular program. My name is Jessica Leese, and I have finished watching this thing. Josh Wigler finished watching this thing. We were all set to talk about it, and then Josh told me he hated it so much that he could not bring himself to talk about it. And so we've brought in, from the front of the bench, one of your favorite podcasters of all time and mine. We call him Podcast Dad around here. I had a dream that I was in a cornfield and an old woman told me to call him up to talk about this show. Mr. Rob Cesternino.
Jess, I'm so excited to be here for The Stand. I don't know what you want to call this. The Stand by me and Rob, whatever you want to do. I'm all here for The Stand. I'm ready for the standoff.
Yeah.
I'm so pumped up that The Stand on CBS All Access, it has a lot of issues, but I am very excited to talk about it.
It's like, it's got so many issues. It's like National Geographic's in your grandma's attic. That's how many issues it has. Although, yes. Yeah, I am sad now. I should say up front, we are not going to be covering this weekly, just because I'm afraid
we'll
that...
see. I'll reserve. If people tell me, look, I'm very impressionable. Here's the deal. You love this. You want to, let me hear from you if you want to hear more about this. Okay. But as of right now, this is it.
This is all you're getting, but trust me, it is a lot that you will be getting.
Yeah. Yes. Jess, did you say you saw the whole series? You watched this whole thing?
I have watched episode one. Josh Wigler has seen a few more episodes than we have because he got some screeners. And yeah, I was warned. I had ample warning because he texted me right after he'd seen the first few episodes. And he said, yeah, I got to tell you, it's bad.
And Josh is not alone in that criticism. Yeah. That every single person that has seen this has said, hey, what did you do here? This was a crazy way to tell this story. And I think that what we want to try to do here today is that we cannot go spoiler free. I don't think that there's a way that we can talk about this show and not get into explaining in more detail what happened and not just a straight recap. I don't think can be done because I think that they made this show only for people who know the story of The Stand.
Yeah, I would venture to say not just people that know the story of The Stand, but people that have read the book semi-recently and people that have probably seen the 94 miniseries more than once. And I feel like that's a very niche audience.
It's very niche. But guess what? That's us.
Yes. Yeah, Rob, why don't you fill in the people a little bit about your history with The Stand? Because I'm really curious to find out.
So Jess, I'm sure, is much, much more knowledgeable than I am about The Stand. But I caught the last hour of the first night of the 1994 miniseries, and perhaps I may have caught the last 20 minutes of the first night of the 1994 miniseries. I was instantly glued. I had never seen anything like that before. I just wanted to know everything about The Stand. At that point in time, I read the full novelization. Gary Sinise and Molly Ringwald headline a 1994 all-star cast that I just looked it up on YouTube. The entire thing is on YouTube, the 1994 miniseries. I might have to watch it again. It's 6 hours on YouTube. I put on 5 minutes of it, and I was like, "Oh, well, this is good. This is coming back to me." I love this story, but I will say that even though it was so impactful to me in 1994, and whenever I read the novelization, which I'm guessing was the summer after it aired, then I have not spent time a lot of recently thinking about this story. And I had been very excited for this remake to come out. And then I started hearing about a lot of problems with the way that they did it. But maybe I had such low expectations coming in. Jess, I really enjoyed this first hour of going back and spending time with these characters that I had not thought about in a very long time.
Well, yeah, Rob. And I think that I don't mean to tell people, I don't mean to warn people off of it here, because I think for a certain type of person that would just devour anything to do with this book, and I think there are people that describes, in fact, friend of the podcast, Mario Lanza, is one of the people that said he was just nuts about it. He thought it was really well done. And I think there was a lot of hype building up to this. And there are indeed some things here that they have done really, really well. But there's one glaring thing. I think we have to start here because, you know, why not? Apparently, the thing everybody does is just jump all over the place. So I'm going to jump right into the middle of it. We're in medias res here on the podcast and on the miniseries. They tell the whole thing out of order. They have decided that they are lost now. Each episode takes a character and shows them in the middle of the action and then jumps back to tell their whole story arc. And it's a weird choice for a story that to me has always felt very, very linear, Rob.
Yeah, it was an absurd way to go on doing this. That I was trying to think about this before. This is sort of like that if you were going to tell Star Wars where you start off and, just spoiler alert for Star Wars, Darth Vader tells Luke Skywalker that he's his son. Then he's pod racing. Then he's having a lightsaber battle with Obi-Wan Kenobi before he falls into lava. Then he's talking to the Emperor where they're trying to bring Luke to Endor. It's like, yeah, okay, I'm trying to follow. Now, I know the story. I could watch Star Wars like that, and I could say, oh, okay, maybe this is interesting. But if you don't know that story, that if you tell it to me out of order, it is going to be very confusing.
Yeah, and honestly, that's kind of, maybe this is a new trend that people should do. Like, you know how people were like doing shot for shot remakes of things for a while? Maybe the new thing is we should just recut things. It's the opposite of chronologically lost, which, P.S., we'll talk about chronologically lost a little bit more, where we just take existing story properties and recut them so that they're in this storytelling style that I think we just have to call it the Lost storytelling style, because I think Lost was the first show that used this as their framing device in a successful way.
But Jess, that the flashbacks that we saw, were the flashbacks even in chronological order?
No.
Because I feel like that they were not.
No, they really weren't. and we also, because we saw, yeah, I don't know, we saw like a little bit of like the middle of the story. And then we jump back to pre-pandemic times, and then we're kind of following.
Could we
also
not call it the pandemic on the stand also?
God, well, how can you not, Rob? Like, this is another thing we need to talk about, because it is a really weirdly hard thing to watch right now. And I saw, you know, 5 months ago, I saw the teaser trailer that said, you know, this is coming soon to CBS All Access. And I'm like, really? Read the room, CBS. Do we really need this right now?
Read the room. Like, yeah.
I mean, why now? Like, why don't they sit on this for another year until we're out of the woods?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if they're trying to yada yada it. Like, I kind of felt like that they were going to go with a bigger push for this. I don't know. Maybe if they felt like that it's never going to be a good time for it. But just, do you feel like that they've gone all out with a release here? Like, I felt like that at one point they were really going to push this hard. But it seems like that this was a very minor push. And maybe they sort of got some of these reviews back.
Yeah, it's sort of like the equivalent of not screening a movie for critics, Although, you know, mm-hmm. they did send out screeners. So I think that, yeah, I remember, of course, in 94, there was a period of like 2 months where you couldn't turn on the television without seeing an ad for the upcoming epic miniseries event. Like that one was hyped to the gills. Like mm-hmm. you couldn't get away from it. And yeah, this has been when they made the initial announcement, I feel like they were revving up for that fanfare. But then it was like, oh, maybe we shouldn't do that. And they got the release date. And then the curious choice yeah. to stick with the release date is the thing I wonder about. And I don't know if they think maybe it's a tale of hope, of good triumphing over evil, which, you know, Lord knows we could use that. Mm-hmm. Or if they just want to highlight, well, you know, you are in a world where large numbers of people are dying of a widespread illness. And yeah. there's a whole segment of the population that's blindly following a demagogue that's clearly pure evil. But, you know, it could be this guy and this disease, and those things are way worse.
Jess, I remember, like, maybe it was like August or September, like when the CBS fall lineup was coming out, that the sort of like intro and outro packages for things, like there were like crows, like that was like the background of CBS. And I was like, wait, why? I don't get it. What is the iconography of crows on CBS? And then it sort of hit me like, oh, they're going to make a really big push of, you know, Watch the Stand on CBS All Access. And at some point along the way, they just seemed like they walked that back. I thought that they were really going to go just all out with this. And I feel like that they're trying to bury it.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's what's happening. Like you barely even, when you turn on CBS All Access, you barely even see
it. It was hard to find.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very hard to find.
Have you heard any buzz? Have you heard anybody talking about this?
No, I mostly like people I know who are hardcore Stephen King fans knew that this was coming.
Yeah.
And they are all still, you know, they're going to stick with it because that's what they do. Like there's so many people that love this book so much that they would watch someone act it out in their kitchen with sock puppets. But
mm-hmm. yeah,
anybody's outside of those circles, like you don't hear people saying, well, now I've got to read this book. Now I'm into this because, you know, this is going to be my fall project.
Has Stephen King commented on the CBS All Access version?
You know, that is a good question, Rob.
I looked on his Twitter timeline. I didn't see anything recently.
Yeah. I mean, even if Stephen King himself is disavowing this, then you know they got problems because.
Oh, it's like the Star Wars holiday special.
Yeah. There's been a lot of bad Stephen King adaptations and he doesn't disown those.
Hmm. Yeah. But yeah. Either way, I really did enjoy this episode of like I was expecting to maybe not enjoy it. For whatever reason, I feel like that the super flu didn't bother me as much. I remember I was petrified in 1994 mm-hmm. of the super flu. I was like, oh, my God, that's it. And now I'm sort of like, we're in a pandemic. I'm like, hey, like, ain't no thing. Like, look at us podcasting away. I do not mean to minimize the pandemic, but no. I'm saying that, hey, look, virus has taken over the world. Like so far, we're okay. We're still that. It's you know, it has not been the apocalypse yet.
Well, I think this raises an interesting point, Rob, that I would love to talk about with you is what do we think, like having read the book, having seen the original miniseries, and now having watched this adaptation, I think here's a global stand related question for you. Now that we've lived through a pandemic and we're still in the midst of a pandemic, yep. What does Stephen King get right and wrong about the pandemic?
Okay, so I thought it was interesting here, if we're going to get to this, that it seems like that in the Stephen King version of it, or as it's presented here in CBS All Access, it seems as though the public officials are the giving out the disinformation, where it seems like, hey, the internet has all the facts. The internet is where you go to get the straight truth. They're like, don't listen to, you know, what they're telling us. Go to the internet. feel like that in practice, I did not find that to be the case.
Yeah, it was kind of the opposite of that. Although I would argue in our world, there were a lot of officials that were not giving you the straight stuff either, but you also didn't have the internet.
It was a mixed bag. Yeah.
Yeah. The number of people that pretend that there is no such thing or say that it's all made up. I feel like in real life, that number was a lot higher. Like the percentage of the population, like everybody in the Stand universe was like, I hear there's this thing and it's killing a lot of people and I'm feeling a little, I feel a little under the weather and I am probably concerned.
You basically in the CBS All Access version, and I don't remember exactly how it was in the 1994 version. You and I have a totally normal conversation. At the end of my conversation, I sneeze or cough. It's allergies. And in the next scene, I am dead.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of one of the other differences, I think. And it's not to say that this kind of thing couldn't happen because, you know, we've seen Ebola. We've seen like the original SARS. But this is a much slower burn, the pandemic we're in right now. And I think maybe the disinformation has a chance to flourish a little bit better because people don't die quite as quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it doesn't seem like anybody is hoarding any supplies here in the CBS All Access Stand. I do not see a run for toilet paper anywhere.
Yeah, they're curiously unconcerned about like they're filling up their bug out shelters. You don't have any of those survivalist people, which is also weird because I feel like that is a trope that Stephen King has been to before. Mm-hmm. And having someone on your side who knows about that kind of stuff would have probably been very beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jess, can I give you a reason why I think that the structure of the timeline here in this episode might have actually been somewhat effective?
Yeah,
can I defend it here for and maybe this is what they were going for?
Yeah, go ahead, Rob, because I have a theory on how this came about as well, but I would love to hear what you think works about it.
Okay, so in this episode, we spend a lot of focus. Probably the person that gets the most screen time in the whole episode is the Harold character. And I wonder, because ultimately, again, this is not just a recap. We're going to talk about things that have not happened yet in this show that we presume, if they stay true to the story that we've seen in the 1994 miniseries and in the novelization of what they're going to do, that I feel like that they did not want you to feel a lot of sympathy for Harold. And by showing you his heel turn here up front, you don't get 6 weeks into, oh, I love Harold. Oh, he's such a great guy. Like, oh, I really think that him and Franny should be together. OTP, Harold and Franny. That I think they end up showing you in episode one who he is and how like it is sort of like that trope of like don't feel any sympathy for this psychopath. Here, like, don't make him into the Joker. He's a sympathetic figure. We're going to go ahead and like really give you his whole backstory. So you might be on his side. And I think that in some ways, maybe that's effective.
I would agree with you there, Rob, especially when you contrast it with Corin Niemek's portrayal of him in the 94 miniseries, where in the beginning, they're almost kind of shipping the two of them. And there's like the same scene where they have the record player and they're sitting in the dark and they're kind of cuddling. And it's like these two kids against the world. And then, you know, spoilers here, it almost plays in the miniseries like Harold would have been okay if an evil Jezebel from Las Vegas had not come and ripped him over to the dark side. And it really plays like Nadine comes in and seduces him away from all that's, you know, pure and good, and he'd be fine on his own. And I do like this change. I do like that he is closer to the Harold of the book and kind of the classic incel, which is really, it's an interesting thing that was not a trope when Stephen King wrote this character, and now it's everywhere. So I do like that. Here's where I have a problem with making Harold our introduction character. There's going to be a big chunk of this audience that doesn't know they're not supposed to sympathize with a guy like that, for starters. Mm-hmm. And also, it is a lot to ask to come back into this world and have a guy with this many toxic attitudes be my tour guide through the first hour of it. And I've never, like, this is not a character that you are supposed to like, but it's strange to me that we spend this much time with him up front, and you almost do get a little sympathy for him in the beginning. Like, he's a bullied kid and he's in love with a girl who'll never love him back. He's a frustrated writer, and it does ask you to feel some sympathy for him up front. It's not the same kind of sympathy, to be sure, but it's also like, yeah, I can understand why he'd be upset. And I don't want to understand why he could be upset like that, because I really think maybe the most horrifying concept that Stephen King, the master of horror, has ever come up with is the idea that everyone in your town dies except the creepy kid that watches you changing through the window. Like, that's just horrible. Like, you're the last two people left on Earth, and you probably just told him not if he was the last guy left on Earth, and now he is. And boy, that is a rough last person on Earth.
So I feel like that they also like want to give us this love triangle here in the first episode. And I don't know, I haven't seen episode two or anything beyond this. So I don't know how, like, if there's going to be some sort of like a small group of characters that we're going to learn about narratively in the next episode, I can only assume. But I think that they really just wanted to establish here, okay, here's Franny, here's Harold. He has a thing for her, but ultimately what's going to happen is she is going to end up with Stu, who is the James Marsden character, who we also spend a lot of time with in this episode. But these two are going to end together, and he is going to be the jilted third party here, and this is going to be crucial to our story.
Yeah, and I think it's crucial in a way that it was not in the past, and I appreciate that. And but I also think it makes it hard for us to then go back and be invested in Franny and Stu, because they are, in many ways, they're kind of like the heart of the original story. But now we know they end up together. We don't know a whole lot about either one of them yet, although we did get to learn a little bit this episode, but we don't feel that attraction to them. It's just like, oh, they're together getting a coffee at the coffee cart now. We don't know anything about how that happened. We don't have a reason to feel like that's what should be happening. And that takes away from who they are as characters. Now, I will say, I think the casting here, like all three of these characters, are very well cast. And I appreciate in particular that Franny now feels like a 20-year-old college student, where, 26-year-old Molly Ringwald had a little bit more difficulty.
Yeah. I don't remember. I'd like to go back and watch the 94 miniseries. I remember a lot of the casting people, but I don't necessarily remember their performances super well. I'd like to go back and take a look at that stuff and see what holds up. Also, like a difference from, and this is very hard to do on a show, but in the novelization that I was doing some rereading on Wikipedia before I came on here, Harold's weight is a big part of the story in the novelization here. Not so here in the either miniseries.
Yeah, and that's an interesting choice as well. But it's also, I believe, in the novel, he undergoes a little bit of a metamorphosis. Like, he starts out, he's overweight and he's got bad acne, and then like he kind of matures and he loses weight and his skin clears up. And I think that's, it's harder to duplicate practical effects, and you also don't want to run the risk of making people seem like they become better people when they lose weight, which was, I think, a blind spot Stephen King had.
Yeah. The original novel is what, 1979?
Yeah, 1979. And then most people younger than a certain age who have read the novel have not read the 1979 version. The original version that came out in 79 was 800 pages. And then in the early 90s, Stephen King went back to it and rewrote some chunks of it and put in huge parts of it that he had cut out of the original. And the 1400 page behemoth is the one that I think most people in 2020 have read, if they've read the book.
Yeah. And I have to be honest, I was looking on Audible before, Jess. I was like, ooh, audiobook. Oh, only 44 hours.
Jeez, nobody wants that. Like 9 hours is going to be a big enough ask. My goodness. Yeah, and I've read both. And I honestly, I think the 79 version is better.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of material I think is gonna that's going to work its way into this miniseries, including apparently Stephen King has written a brand new ending for this. So who knows what that's going to be? Or maybe we'll get it next episode. Don't even know.
Yeah. Now, that's the weird part. Now, it's being marketed as, oh, and there's a brand new, they call it a coda. I'm not smart enough. What does that mean, a coda?
Well, in music, a coda is like, it's like an extended ending. You can finish the song at a certain point, or you can finish it a different way from how you have resolved every other phrase. And so a coda is more like, it's like an epilogue, I guess.
Feel like that we're going to get like a jump 5 years ahead. Like, I think that that's what it's going to be, some sort of like go out into the future after this. Like, I do not think that the ending of the show is going to be different.
So it's like it's going to be like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High or Animal House ending. Like, you could freeze frame and like, you know, Stu and Fran rode off into the sunset and had several more children and.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But I would suspect that there are two different endings. The 79 book and the 94 edition are very different as well in the endings. And there's a coda on that book. And I'm going to be really annoyed if that's all we're getting for the new ending.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was just stupid. Wait,
do you know what is the big difference in the ending?
Yeah, the big difference in the ending. Well, the big difference in the ending is in the 79 book, it ends with the birth of Franny's child. And the baby is going to survive. And they're like, well, is this signal a new beginning? And she looks up and she says, I don't know. And Franny looks up, not the child, but.
Not the baby. Not the baby. That'd be wild.
That would be wild. Although it's all, you know, the actual ending of the revised edition is almost as wild as that. Because you get that scene. Then you get an epilogue where they decide, like, the baby gets a little older and Stu and Fran decide to leave the community in Boulder and strike out on their own and find a new place to live. And then it cuts to, like, some island that has been unaffected by the plague where there's an uncontacted tribe living. And then Flag walks up the beach and he's like, hey, I'm going to teach you how to be civilized. And that's the end.
Yeah, that's dumb.
That's super dumb.
That is dumb.
Yeah, that's, you know, there's been, you know, Stephen King has trouble ending things sometimes. Like, just look to the novelette of The Mist and then the movie version that finds how that was supposed to have ended and ends it. So, I hope that's not the direction they're going. And I think Stephen King wrote the ending is kind of like, well, that sounds like a good thing on its face, but then think about the way that Stephen King ends things, and maybe not so much. But okay. I
wish I had a good comparison for Stephen King wrote the ending.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that comparison is, but someone I'm sure will tell us in the comments. I do want to think a little bit more about this nonlinear storytelling format, because I think it does make a lot of this story incredibly incomprehensible if you don't know who you're supposed to be rooting for.
How could anybody just come in and watch this first episode? Like, I would love to, like, if we could find that person. Yeah. If we have, like, a friend of the podcast who has not seen this, show them the first episode, and then, like, let's give them a quiz of what were their takeaways.
Yeah, we'll find the undecided voter out there.
Yes.
And get their take on it, because it really does make the story, like, it takes away all of the stakes. It takes away, like, I feel like this is a road trip novel and a road trip, you know, it's a road trip story. It's ultimately people are taking a journey. They take two different journeys, and the book is even divided up into that. There's the first journey, the people coming together and meeting each other and forming the bonds and building a mini society. And then there's the second journey of going to face the menace of the Dark Man. And if you don't show the journey, how do you build to any of that? That's the part that I'm having a lot of trouble with. And it also, if I thought that was really what they intended to do, I think that plays differently as well, but I don't think any of this feels deliberate at all. it feels like every individual scene is very well shot and well acted, and every scene on its own is engaging, and a lot of them are ripped directly from the book. A couple are ripped directly from the miniseries, mm-hmm. which is interesting. And that, to me, like, I know those scenes backwards and forwards, and that's fun to me, but it really, I want to see the chronologically lost style re-edit of this, where someone just takes everything and plunks it all in order, because I think that's probably going to be a very good miniseries. But this, mm-hmm. as it is, it feels like, you know, someone went into a boardroom and said, well, you know, this Stand thing is coming out and we're up against some, you know, some really tough current events. And I don't know if people are going to want to watch this, but what are the kids like? The kids like that Lost show where everybody has a flashback. Could we retell it mm-hmm. in a flashback style? We shot all this stuff and we need to do something different. Like, let's shake it up. Yeah. And I think they might have even made this decision after they shot everything.
So it's interesting. So there's an interview from Entertainment Weekly, and this is from James Hibbard, who talked to Benjamin Cavell, the showrunner for this. And they asked him, like, why did you do this out of order? He says, I feel like that the audience is savvy enough at this point to follow along. I doubt people would have thought that James Marsden was going to die due to Captain Trips and not be with us for the whole series. It's a completely valid question. I just don't know that it's the juice of the early part of the series. It's not so much about whether the characters are going to die, but rather, what is the horror that's going to befall them? How are they going to figure out how to push back against the evil? So I guess he's feeling like, all right, well, that it's, you know, that your favorite characters are not gonna, the protagonists are not gonna die in the first part of the thing. So let's speed this up. Let's get to the middle.
Yeah, but they did that. Like, the book does that. The book says, okay, there's good guys and bad guys. And the good guys are going to meet each other and they all have the same dream. And the bad guys are going to meet each other and they all have the same dream. There's some people in the middle that kind of have both of the dreams. Yeah. And that's where the struggle is. But you meet the bad guy and you meet, you know, you have Team Abigail, you have Team Flag, and then they, you know, they have the road trip. And
yeah,
I don't know what it accomplishes. Like, what does it change up? Like, we already know there's a bad thing out there. I don't think, in fact, I think this episode, we didn't really learn anything about the bad thing. We saw like yeah. one very low budget shot of Harold having the dream about Flag.
I don't know necessarily if this was like in response to the COVID-19. They say in this interview, also, they say it was always part of the original plan and not something that they changed due to COVID-19. I just think that the director just said, well, I don't want to just do a straight remake of 1994. They already mm-hmm. did that. And so how do I put my spin on that? How do I do a remix?
Yeah. And so they threw the script into a blender and then just kind of mm-hmm. went with whatever came out. Yeah, I mean, I don't honestly think that they thought about this as the pandemic was coming in and decided that nobody wants to watch the first 5 hours of like the entire world dying of a disease. I could see like that is a very good reason not to do it that way. But I do think that it was a conscious choice on some level. I just wish it felt more deliberate. Because I think mm-hmm. it was deliberate. I just don't think it comes off that way.
Yeah. I mean, who's supporting this? Who's I'm loving this. I feel like the only people that are watching this are people that have already, seen.
Well, yeah. And Mario is the one person I've talked to who really loved it. And mm-hmm. he is diehard. Like, he's more of a fan of this than you or I. And yeah. he loves it because every scene is like pretty, you know, it's pretty well realized. The additions that they've made are pretty good. I want to talk actually about the first scene that we see, like the thing that introduces us.
Can I just also
us.
Add just that I did, like, I think it's insane how they did this, but I also still enjoyed it.
Yeah, there were parts of it I definitely enjoyed. I want to talk about something I really didn't enjoy that was well executed. I want to talk about that very first scene because I think this is also a really interesting study when you compare it to the 94 miniseries because the 94 miniseries opens with like this sweeping shot of a lab and they play Blue Oyster Cult over it. And it's just like corpse, 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 corpse. And you know, something that's really bad has escaped from this lab. And the scene that the new version chooses to open with is also corpse, 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 corpse. But mm-hmm. It is my least favorite scene in both the book and the miniseries because it's just so creepy and gross. And it is all of these people went to church and then just fell down dead of the flu inside the church. And the crew of body retrieval people, which includes Harold, is going in to retrieve all these bodies. And it is really, it's almost like one of the, a lot of the things in the miniseries are sort of played for laughs when you run into a corpse. And this is really not that. And it is
super gross.
Yeah, super gross. And they also, I don't know how scientifically accurate this is, but you know, months after all of these people died inside this church, they are full of maggots and there's worms crawling out of eye sockets and all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
And it is your real sense that something terrible happened and a lot of people died and here's who's left. And it's a really, it's a, I think that's the one time it feels like opening the series in the middle of the action is a good thing because you do learn a lot just from this. And you learn that they, you know, they're going to rebuild. They're going to be okay. And, but it does kind of take some of the stakes away from the whole road trip aspect of it because you don't know where they're going to end up or how many people they're going to run into. And now we know it's like a pretty functioning town.
And not just that, it's also like I needed IMDb to know like, oh, okay, that's this character.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That he's talking, that's Nick he's talking to about making the movie theater. Like, oh, okay. Like, I got that. Like, I don't even, they don't need, like, if it, a couple things, like, if you could lower third some people here, if you're going to come in the middle of the action, that would help me.
We watch too much reality TV. It's like, you know, Harold Lauder, Ogunquit, Maine, nerd.
Also, you know, if you want to jump around in time, give me the date. Tell me, like, April 10th. Okay. June 30th. Got it.
Yes, because they do that in the original. They do that all through the novel, and they don't even have to because you know what direction it is and how much time has passed. And they do it anyway. And I really would have appreciated that as well. Like, just tell us. It even do the Walking Dead thing where they're like, before.
Before, 2 months ago, one month ago. Okay, that would also help.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you're digging up the body, so now you're off work and you're riding your bike. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just, can I ask you about the cutout of Tom Cruise? Where does this figure into things? Because if anything, we know how Tom Cruise feels about how people should be behaving during a pandemic. And Tom Cruise, I think, if he was running that super lab, he'd make sure that it is in tip-top shape.
Well, that is true, Rob. It's like the one time I've ever agreed with Tom Cruise on anything.
It's
pretty interesting that we get these two pieces of information within a week of each other. But I liked this device as well. This is an addition that's not, it's not in the book, and it's something that I think they've crafted specifically for this adaptation. And that's something else.
Tom Cruise magazine in the 1979 novelization?
No, it wasn't about like the one TV commercial Tom Cruise had done up to that point. But, you know, the 94 one, certainly that was, there was a lot more Tom Cruise material to mine in the 94 edition, and they chose not to. But this is an interesting choice because I think it really highlights the way that Harold is putting on a face because it's not who he really is.
Yeah.
And I liked that a lot. And it's also, it's an interesting thing that they have to do for this adaptation. The original miniseries was adapted from a book that took place in 1990 and the original book took place in 1980. And they have a lot of technology that they have to contend with that the 1994 miniseries did not. And it's interesting the way that they have chosen to portray this, and they've done it in very small, subtle ways. And this is one of them, like the idea that you could build a movie theater. Like, it is very easy. I could build a movie theater tomorrow if I wanted to with the technology we have now.
Would you show Risky Business?
God, no. I don't like Tom Cruise.
It's like a weird call. Like, that's the, like, Risky Business. That's the movie.
Yeah. And also, there were like 500 DVDs in there, and he's telling me that Risky Business is the best one.
Yeah. Also, I think that first movie back after the super flu, I feel like let's go something Pixar. Let's make it a family thing.
Yeah, I think we want, I don't know if WALL-E is the right choice here.
Probably not, but you know, an R-rated movie. I believe there's a call girl that is part of the storyline there.
Yeah, but on the other hand, Rob, there are not any children in this world. There are like three children that had the good fortune to be found by someone who could take care of them, and all the rest of the children. In fact, Stephen King has a really upsetting chapter in the unabridged version where it's like there were a lot of people that survived the plague, but then died because there were no other people around.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's like one child. I think there's two children in the original book. There's like one little girl that is found because she has a broken arm and some nice people find her. And then there's Joe, the feral child, who's found by Lucy, who ends up like she and Larry become a thing. So that is.
Still, I'm still going to defend the call. I'm going with a comedy here. First movie back.
Yeah.
I think we need something light.
We do need something light. I mean, Risky Business is supposed to be
caper.
A comedy.
It's a caper. Yeah.
I don't know if that's the one I'd go to either. I agree with you on this, but I don't know that you have to limit yourself to the realm of G-rated films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think you could go with something. You could go for an Apatow movie, maybe.
Yeah, maybe some of the earlier stuff. Maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, Jess.
Yeah.
Can we talk? You want to talk a little bit about Stu Redman?
I think we better talk about Stu Redman. Who is the ostensible protagonist. He's kind of the main guy, really launched Gary Sinise's career. I believe that original Stand came out before Forrest Gump.
Yes. Yeah. And, 94. What a year for Gary Sinise.
Yeah. I think that was, you know, they call it on the Rewatchables podcast, they call that Apex Mountain. And I think he's had a great career. He's obviously a very talented actor, but I don't think it was ever as awesome for him as the back-to-back roles of Lieutenant Dan and Stu Redman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was the standout performance, and there were some very good performances in that miniseries.
Is that the award for best performance in this show, is the standout performance?
Yes, the standout performance. Yeah. He's a stand-up guy, Stu Redman is.
Yes, unlike Lieutenant Dan.
Yes. Well, by the end of the movie, you know, spoilers, but...
Yeah.
So,
comes around.
Yeah, Stu Redman, played by Gary Sinise in the original miniseries, he's kind of... He is your introductory character because he's the first person to be exposed to the virus who ends up not dying from it.
Yeah.
And so you see, like, he is one of the very first people that meets the guy that broke out of the test facility and unleashed this onto the world. And you see how the government tries and fails to contain it. And so his introduction is like, everybody else around him is dying and he feels fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, I think James Marsden is doing a fine job. He's doing an okay job. These are the second hardest shoes to fill in this entire miniseries. And I think anybody that's going to be watching this that has familiarity with the universe is just going to be like, oh, yeah, there's not Gary Sinise.
Yeah. He's always fine. I mean, he's the same, James Marsden.
Yeah. He's, you know, he's playing it as more of like a, he's like, look how good looking I am. Where I think Gary Sinise was more down to earth.
Yeah. Well, I think it was sort of like the Southern twang, I think, that Gary Sinise was doing there.
Well, his iconic line in there is country don't mean dumb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But he's the same as Westworld.
Yeah.
The same as anything else that you've ever seen James Marsden in.
Yeah. I mean, you did that in 30 Rock, for crying out loud.
Yeah. What was the one where he was the prince? Enchanted?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Yeah. It was a little more comedy there. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he has a wheelhouse and he's not out of it in this.
Yeah. So, yeah, he's good casting. Did you like the poor man's Dr. Fauci that James Marsden spends all his time hanging out with?
Boy, I think this plays differently because of the times we're in, because this guy really is Fauci-esque. This is an interesting choice to flesh this role out a bit, because you did have that. This is in the book a little bit, but they don't form a bond the same way they do here in this series.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah. I liked that he was a nice guy. He had, he had a mission and he was trying to carry out his mission. And along the way, he realized he was doing some terrible things to people, but he really he kept his humanity. And I think Stu is the person that helped him keep his humanity. So you have that kind of interplay between the two of them. And I appreciated this also helps you get to know Stu, because Stu is not someone who's easy to get to know if he's just in a cell by himself, not communicating with people.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciated that. Helped us get to know him a little bit better.
Yeah. So we get to know him a little bit, and he ultimately, I feel like that people are at different stages when they decide that they're going to wrap things up. I thought that was interesting. Like some people, they seem like, you're not even that, you got another whole day to go.
Yeah. Yeah, that was.
I'd be eating all of the junk food. I feel like I would be treating this a lot differently of I've got a day of do whatever I want. No consequences.
Yeah, I'd be down. But,
Yeah. I mean, look at J.K. Simmons. he was when he was like, hey, I found this book. I can't put it down. I thought he'd spend the rest of the day reading.
Yeah, you'd think. I mean, he knows he's on his way out, so why not finish the book? This is he's not Desmond trying to read Charles Dickens here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did you think of J.K. Simmons in this role?
Yeah, that was good. Always surprise J.K. Simmons.
I do, too. Do you remember this character in the original miniseries?
I do not.
Because this is really funny, and it's really funny that it's J.K. Simmons when you know this, because in the original miniseries, this character was played in a similarly uncredited cameo by Ed Harris. And for that reason, I could not remember what this character's name actually was. I'm just that's Ed Harris. And I still don't remember what the guy's name is. It's just for me, he's always going to be Ed Harris. And it was kind of a similar thing where they got this big name actor to do this tiny role and they didn't really flash it around. And to the point where you're looking at him and you're like, is that really him? I'm not sure. And you can't find anything about it. So you're not sure if it's him or not until you're like, yeah, it's got to be him. So that was, I feel like J.K. Simmons is probably the Ed Harris of this era. I like that choice a lot.
Yeah. Okay. Can we talk about Randall Flagg?
Yeah, this is an interesting casting choice too, for sure. Yes. Because, what were your thoughts on original Recipe Randall Flagg, played by Jamie Sheridan in the 94 miniseries?
So I don't really have too many takes that I remember, but I am going to relook at the 1994 version on YouTube.
Yeah, I have a lot of feelings about this because he was I've never seen this actor in anything else, which was also interesting. He just kind of comes out of nowhere and he's
had a mullet, right?
Yeah, he had a mullet. Or he at least had long hair. I don't know if it was officially.
I remember him in a lot of denim and with a mullet.
He had the Canadian tuxedo, and I don't think there was business in the front, but there was definitely party in the back.
For sure.
Yeah. And he had this denim jacket with a lot of little buttons on it. And he sort of had this kind of aw shucks demeanor to him but the way that he played it, it was he's kind of cheesy in the front. And then but there's this, something is not right. It's a little uncanny valley. There's just something a little bit off about him. And
does he get devil horns at some point?
Yes. And the part where he when he loses control of himself, he became this super cheesy, 1960s zipper up the back plastic suit horror movie monster. And that was my favorite thing about the original miniseries. And I don't even know if it was intentional, was that when he got angry and lost control and started being full on evil guy, he looked super cheesy and dumb. And it was he's scarier when he's his regular self, when he's got the veil on. And I loved that about him. And I thought his performance, people don't really talk about it. They talk about Gary Sinise. They talk about Ruby Dee, who I'm sure we're going to get to. And they don't really talk about this role because it's really unsung. But he was really, for me, that's the thing I remember was how weirdly unsettling this cheesy guy in the Canadian tuxedo was. And then when I found out who was playing Flagg in this miniseries, I was like, what the hell? Why?
Oh, you don't like Skarsgård.
I love Skarsgård. That's the thing. Why is Randall Flagg going to be sexy all of a sudden?
Oh, no.
I don't want to have that kind of feelings for Randall Flagg. Yeah. That's kind of not okay, but it's an interesting way to take the character.
Well, I used to be a big True Blood guy. I watched the first couple seasons of True Blood before I was like, my feelings on True Blood are similar to my feelings on Community. Of like, first couple of, oh, this is great. It's like, wait, what are they doing? This is, what is this? It's like, there's fairies now. All right, I'm out.
It was like they took all of the things that I didn't like in the books and they kept those, and then they changed all of the things I did like in the books.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're talking about True Blood.
Yeah, I'm talking about True Blood. It's kind of the same thing. I think it's the same thing here. But we didn't see very much Randall Flagg in this first episode.
No, like, but I loved what they did with him.
Yeah, very mysterious. Well, I knew you were going to like that because you are a Billy Joel stan. But
they're trying to win me over. They're doing a good job.
Pandering directly to Rob Cesternino.
Yes.
I thought that was fun, and it's also kind of a sly wink at the original miniseries that that used Blue Oyster Cult to great effect in the first scene of the miniseries. It's like, yeah, we can take pop music that you might have forgotten about, and we're going to spin it and make it cool again.
The 94 miniseries had a great soundtrack.
It did. Well, it had two songs in it, and then it had like two and a half songs, basically. It had Blue Oyster Cult's Don't Fear the Reaper, and it had Don't Dream It's Over by Crowded House, which is...
Yes, I still think every time I hear that song, I think of the Stand.
Yeah, me too. Although it's also one of my all-time favorite songs and was before that. So that was... I loved that. And it's weird the things that they changed here. Like it was a Black Sabbath song, I believe they're listening to, where they listened to Crowded House in the original. And then they used The Stranger for Randall Flagg, and it's really eerie, and it's when I first heard it, I'm like, oh God, this is cheesy, but it's not cheesy. It works really, really well.
It works really, really well. And they did make that a little bit of a tweak when we end up seeing the lab start to have the meltdown.
Yes.
Where we see that somebody or something is holding the door open for the guy to escape.
It's the reverse Hodor.
Yes, reverse Hodor, and we see that it's a Randall Flagg.
Yeah, it's
holding the door.
Same boot, and I kind of like that.
That was cool.
Yeah, I kind of like that. Although it does kind of take some of the culpability off of the foibles of humanity here. Like it's like, oh, Randall Flagg wanted this to happen, so he made it happen. And in the original, there's a lot of commentary on like the duality of good and evil and about how, you know, man's evil impulses to create this super virus were, you know, our ultimate undoing. And, you know, flew too close to the sun kind of thing. And now it's like,
flew too close to the sun.
Yes. Yes, indeed. We flew too close to, we super flew too close to the sun. Then we Captain Tripsed.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That's right.
Captain Trips, I feel like that seems like a 1979 term. I don't know if in the 2020 version that would be the nickname.
They refer to it once. They don't really they don't really dwell on it the way that they did in the book.
Captain Trips will get you by, all right.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
We'll make you die tonight.
See, this is why we need the standoff. I'm
so ready for the standoff. I could go into it right now.
Yeah, I'm here for it. Like, and honestly, if we get somebody to send a song parody, I will definitely recap the entire rest of this series.
Okay. Interesting.
Here for it. But I think we should probably note that we had originally intended to recap every episode of this, and without Josh on board, I'm not sure that's going to happen. However, we do want to hear from you if this is something you want. So
is anybody listening to this? I don't know. I'm having a great time, Jess.
Yeah, me too. Me too. This is really fun, and I think it would continue to be fun. It's a funny thing. Like, I said to Josh, when he said he was completely out on it, I said, well, you know, all the people that always come at us saying, if you hate this show so much, why do you bother recapping it? I feel like this is a win for them. And then, yeah, he said, I don't think I do my best podcasting when I hate something.
No,
and
Josh has to love what he's talking about.
Yeah. And then you, on the other hand, said, I feel like I'm doing my best work when I hate what I'm watching.
Yeah. Which was not this that I did not hate this, but I do feel like that sometimes I watch something that I hate so much I need to talk about it. But that's not this. That this is I feel like I'm seeing old friends that I just haven't seen in a very long time.
Yeah. I mean that's true. And I think there's a lot here for people that it's almost like you're watching actors in repertory staging your favorite scenes from a book that you enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not like taken as a whole. I don't think it works and I don't think it's going to work, but you know, I could also reserve judgment. I might watch the next scene and I might be, you know, the next set of scenes might have me all in on this. Like it might make more sense once I've seen a little bit more of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the original story to me is a little bit, and I said this to you over text, is it's kind of like a fever dream for me. Like I sort of like remember like, oh, wait, I think that this person was there. I think that this person was there. And then watching this, it's like, oh, yes. This guy. Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, that guy with that thing. That's
makes sense.
Be.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. So, no, I really did enjoy this. Does Harold write like a maniac on a typewriter in either the novel or in the 94 miniseries?
I want to say he does. I want to say that's a thing that he's kind of known for because I think he does. Because the point after he kills everybody, he writes a manifesto and signs it and he writes it on a typewriter because I think he gets used to having a typewriter when there's no electricity.
He took the typewriter with him on the motorcycle.
I'm sure there are typewriters to be found. Like that was something I feel like it was like the one attractive thing of the post-apocalyptic universe is like everybody's stuff is up for grabs.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. And I think, well, the typewriter was more important to him because, you know, when this took place in 1980, they didn't have laptops, but you know, he doesn't have a laptop anymore either. Cause he smashed it.
Jess, who are you looking forward to seeing in the Stand CBS All Access version?
Well, some of the casting. There's some really interesting casting choices that I would really like to see. I want to see more of Flag, of course. I want to see Greg Kinnear as Glenn Bateman because that's a really weird choice.
I don't remember Glenn Bateman. What character is that?
Okay, Glenn Bateman.
What does he do?
Was played in the 94 miniseries by 80-year-old character actor Ray Walston. And he was a retired sociology professor, and he's kind of this like wise old man. And that's a complete 180 from like affable late middle aged Greg Kinnear. So that's a very different thing. There was also a character in the novel called Ralph Brentner, who was this kind of like hick from Oklahoma, and he really didn't have much to do in the miniseries. I don't remember the name of the actor who played him. It was like. He was kind of a nothing burger, just a guy with a cowboy hat who drove a pickup truck and was friends with Nick and Tom. And they have gender swapped this character.
Oh, interesting.
And her name is now Ray Brentner, and she is played by an actress named Irene Bedard, whose most famous role up to this point, she was the voice of Pocahontas in the Disney movie. That is a casting choice that I want to see what they are doing with that role now, because that's a much more interesting character to me and somebody that's potentially going to have a lot more to do. I mean, given the novel, Ralph doesn't do very much. He's just sort of like the fourth person to round out the quartet that goes to Las Vegas to make the titular stand. So there's that. There's some casting choices I don't know how I feel about. And I think specifically, I want to talk about Nick Andros as a character that everybody remembers him if they watched the 94 miniseries. I'm sure you remember Nick.
Rob Lowe, right?
Yeah, Rob Lowe. Because
did I tell you I've been watching The West Wing?
Oh boy, that's like the next big Rob Lowe role. The West Wing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's 99. Is it? I feel like he did like Spin City in between.
Oh
then,
yeah, and he had
right?
another
did
series.
That's Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, it was Charlie Sheen. He had a couple of series, like a couple of attempts at a series before landing on The West Wing and The West Wing taking off. Like gangbusters. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Rob Lowe peaked in the 80s. He was part of the Brat Pack. And then you didn't see him. Similar to Molly Ringwald, you didn't see him for a while. And then
he
shows up.
Yeah, this was like bring back a bunch of people.
Yeah, this was his, you know, this was his John Travolta in Pulp Fiction. Yeah. And he was excellent in it. But in 94, I feel like you could get away with having a hearing actor play a deaf character. in a way that you really shouldn't be able to get away with in 2020. And yet that is what they did.
Yes, I saw the controversy about Henry Zaga.
Yeah, and I'm sure he's going to do a fine job. And there's one scene, I think, where, you know, Tom Cullen has a dream where Nick appears to him and can hear and speak. And I think they didn't want to mess with that, although I think there's ways you could get around with that and do it differently that maybe are a little more sensitive and don't treat the deafness like it's a giant character flaw, which they sort of did. And I didn't love that. You have people like Niall DeMarco out there who is a great actor and actually deaf. You have people like Sean Burdy, who was in the show Switched at Birth, who really, like, he was kind of stole the entire show out from everybody else. You have actors out there that you could cast and they didn't even consider it. And I find that that's going to make it really hard for me to get invested in this character.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think we got to talk about Tom Cullen, who is another character. Yes. I think, like, every time somebody quotes The Stand, they are quoting Tom Cullen for
M-O-O-N.
The most part. Yep.
Yeah. That spells Brad William Hinkie.
Yeah, Brad William Hinkie. I don't know, Rob, have you seen him in anything before?
No, I've seen he's in Orange is the New Black. I'm trying to see. I'm looking at his IMDb if there's anything that I would have seen him in.
I mean, that's the only thing I've seen.
He's in Lost. Who is he in Lost?
He was in Lost?
Six episodes. Bram is his character.
Bram? Okay, I'm going to have to.
He sits on the Iron Throne at the end of Lost, I think.
I do not remember him being in Lost, so I'm going to have to go back to. Yeah, I'm going to have to go back to.
Probably like one of the others, like in the background.
Yeah, he's probably. Yeah, he's random.
He looks like a freighter guy.
Yeah, he's definitely not like one of the blue striped shirt lady types. Not like a Frogert. But I'm going to have to ask Mike and Josh about that because I did not remember that. I do think he played a role in Orange is the New Black that was very memorable, and it's going to be very hard for me to get past that to see him as Tom Cullen, especially when I think that was another one of the really perfectly cast roles in the original.
Do you remember the original Tom Cullen was Dauber from Coach?
Yes, Dauber from Coach. And the way that Stephen King describes the appearance and mannerisms of this character, like, Bill Fagerback gets them perfectly. He's amazing. And it's like, it's not a great written character. It's kind of insulting. And I think they try to move away from that in this adaptation. So I'll be interested to see how that is and also how you can look past a pure evil character that he's played before and into this like innocent childlike Tom Cullen. That'll be very weird. I want to talk. We can't leave this podcast without talking about Whoopi Goldberg.
Whoopi, yes. Whoopi is one of the patron saints of Robin and Kevin Need a Podcast, right?
Yes, I do. I believe she's the star of Eddie, which is your favorite movie.
Yes, we have Eddie. We have a spot in the crappy movie diaper called the Whoopi Cushion, which is that we always have to have a Whoopi Goldberg film in the crappy movie diaper. So we are always talking about Whoopi's works. We love Whoopi. And so I hope that this will not be a future entrant into the crappy movie diaper, The Stand. But here is Whoopi as Mother Abigail. Mother!
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't think you're going to get Akiva to watch 9 hours of something. So that's probably a non-starter already.
But boy, he watches that football every week.
Yeah, but that's football. You know, that's something he likes.
The goal line stand.
You know, I feel like I can hear Akiva saying, like, yeah, is Stephen King an author that people read? Like, I don't know. I didn't read him growing up, so I don't know about that. But I, you know, is this somebody
nerdy.
Has everybody heard of this guy? Is this somebody that I should know? That feels to me like where you're going to be at when you try to get Akiva to watch The Stand. And, I have to say, I do not like Whoopi in this role at all from the 3 minutes of her that I've seen. Do not like her. It's really...
Okay.
Yeah.
What is it that you don't like about Whoopi in this role?
Like, it doesn't feel like she's playing a character. It feels like I went in the corn and I found Whoopi Goldberg. And she like... It's like, you know, corn guinan.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, that I read the Alan Sepinwall review, and I think that he made the comparison from Mother Abigail to Guinan.
Yeah, and that's all I can see. Ruby Dee just, like, disappears into the role when she played her. in 94. Mm-hmm. And she's like this kind of gentle, frail character. And, you know, you feel this sense of like, of peace coming out of her when you have the corn dream and you go in, you see Mother Abigail and she talks to you and it's like, oh, I feel this sense of peace. And we didn't really get the corn dream very much in this episode. No. When we did, it was just like, oh, I went in the corn and I found Whoopi Goldberg. Okay. I don't really know what to do with this. She's got white dreadlocks. Yeah. So I guess she's old. She doesn't look 108.
I also feel like that this Mother Abigail character, I think that may have been novel, no pun intended, in 1979. I feel like that there have been a lot of movies and TV shows that have really, either borrowed heavily from this to the point where that it just feels like, oh, this again?
Yeah. There is that. There's also like some problematic racial implications of, I think she was just about the only person of color in the whole novel. And it's like, it's the trope of the magical Negro. And that's very difficult, to portray in a sensitive way anymore. Because it's been done so many times, as you note. So I appreciate the challenges of that, and I think they're right to do something different with it, but I don't know if this is the different thing to do, like just to make it a very recognizable character actor playing themselves is it's weird, and I don't know how I'm supposed to buy that as being like the conduit for good versus the embodiment of ultimate evil.
Yeah. So we'll see what Whoopi can do with it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited. She's everything Whoopi does is either really excellent or really terrible. And I don't think she's ever the deciding factor in either of those. Like, for every ghost, there is a Theodore Rex.
Yeah. Very excited to talk about that. That's currently in the crappy movie diaper. So we'll see about that. Yeah. Welcome to Colorado. Welcome to Colorado. Welcome to Colorado. Welcome to Colorado. Welcome to Colorado.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Oh, we need to talk about geography a little bit. Yes. I know, we're wrapping things up here, but I want to talk
about my strong suit.
No. They are skipping Nebraska entirely, so I think that is maybe explaining the relative dearth of cornfield dreams. They're just like, yeah, go straight to Colorado. Don't worry about it.
Okay, so in the original, so Mother Abigail's in Nebraska, and she tells them go to Colorado?
Well, she tells them go to Nebraska and meet me there, and then we'll figure out what we're going to do. And then they decide to go to Colorado from there. Like, they all convene around Mother Abigail, and then she says, well, we need to find a town where we can rebuild, because we're going to have more people than this. So they go to Boulder, Colorado. And
tough to hike to Boulder.
Yeah, it's a little bit rough. And we get also the curious choice. They put Stu Redman in Stovington, Vermont in the novel and in every adaptation. And because there's a CDC center there, and they have Harold and Franny in Maine. And the reason that they end up connecting with Stu Redman in the book and everywhere except this is Harold says, I know there's a CDC place. There's a lab in Stovington, Vermont. Maybe if there's people, there will be people there. So we should check that out first. And they go down, and Stu has left Stovington, and they run into him shortly after that. But this time they're like, oh, we should go to Atlanta. Because there's a CDC thing. And like, how do you get to Colorado from Maine through Atlanta? And if you're going to have Stu be in Stovington to begin with, like, why wouldn't you just start there? That doesn't make any sense to me. And I'm sure they're going to explain it next week, but I thought that was a curious thing to gloss over. And it would have been funnier if they'd said, well, I remember in Walking Dead, when there was a pandemic, they went down to Atlanta because that was where the CDC lab is, and they had showers and stuff. Maybe we should just go there.
Yep. Has The Walking Dead been a show in this universe?
I feel like every time you do a show where a plague wipes out most of humanity, nobody has ever written a book about it before. Like, nobody ever saw this coming. And I feel like I would find it really amusing if they had one of those sometime where somebody's like there's a zombie there's a zombie plague and somebody's like, this is kind of like in The Stand that one time. I would love that. Like somebody knows the mm-hmm. existence of it, but it's a thing in Walking Dead. They don't use the word zombie because there was no, you know, there was no Dawn of the Dead and there was no World War Z. It's all like a brand new concept.
You want like the Jamie Kennedy character in Scream in the disease movie.
And it really feels to me like Harold could have been that character.
Yeah, could have been.
I think he would have been that character if they'd thought about it for more than 5 seconds.
Yeah. Then next week, the next episode, who do you think we're going to see?
It's probably going to be Larry. He's a second lead. He's a musician who has written a song. I can't wait to hear their version of Baby, Can You Dig Your Man?
Yep. Who do you think he's going to meet up with? Nadine?
Yeah, well, here's a thing that's different, and I did spoil myself a little bit. In the miniseries, Nadine is a composite of two characters.
Oh.
Larry meets Nadine in New York City, and they escape New York together, and they wind up going all the way to Colorado. And in the book, he meets up with somebody different first, and she is kind of a little more emotionally fragile, and she doesn't make it all the way there. Spoilers, sorry. And then he meets Nadine at some other point later in the series, and they become sort of romantically involved. But when we meet Larry, we're also going to meet this other character, and I forget what her name is, but she's going to be played by Heather Graham in this.
So Roller Girl.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and I enjoy her. I don't know why she doesn't do more, but every time she's in something, I enjoy her, so I'll be happy to see her.
Well, she, like, famously was in, like the first show ever to be canceled after one night.
Yeah. Has
she
done anything else? Emily's Reasons Why Not. Yeah, she's done a lot, but I'm surprised
was such a punchline at the time. She has not worked a lot in the last decade.
No, but she was solid in The Hangover.
Tribeca, I guess she did.
She did The Hangover.
I retract that. It's just that she has not done a lot in things I have seen.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's fair. She works steadily, but you never hear of anything that she's in. So when I heard she was going to be in it, I thought that's really fun. And I'll be interested to see like how much of that story they tell, because it was something I think they decided. They're going a little darker with this, too, because they didn't let Franny try to kill herself in the miniseries originally. And
in the 94 miniseries.
Yeah, the 94 miniseries. And she is a little bit more haunted and upset by everything going on around them. They're really weirdly blasé about the fact that everybody is dead in the 94 miniseries, which is one of its failings.
This is very, very dark. I mean, there was one scene with Harold that I was like, what, really? We're going here on CBS All Access?
Oh, yeah. I know what scene you're talking about. Don't really want to go there here.
The whole thing is so disjointed. I'm like, wait, who is that? Wait, what is that? Who's in the picture? What is that? Wait, and then it hit me like a few hours after I watched it. I was like, that his sister is in the picture and he's falling. And he's got that. Ah, okay.
No, it's not his sister. It's, but it's, you know, it's.
I thought it was a picture of Franny and his sister because they're best friends.
Oh, and then it's Franny and his sister, and he's covering up his sister. Okay, at least his sister's not in the picture while it's going on.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But that's like, I think a little bit of like, don't like this guy. This is a he's a bad boy.
Yep, he's gonna go blind, keep doing stuff like that.
Okay. Jess, anything else you want to say about The Stand?
No, I think you've convinced me, Rob. I'm gonna give it another episode.
Gonna give it another episode. You love it.
I don't love it. I was mad at it. I'm really mad at it for this curious narrative choice to tell everything out of order in a way that only diehards are going to get it. Like, I can spot, like, this is the difference between this and that, and this is what they did in the book, and they're doing it differently here. I can do that. I don't think everybody should have to do what I did, and I don't think anybody should. I think I know too much about The Stand. I don't think they should make things for people that know this much about The Stand.
Okay.
So that's how I feel about it. But since they have made it in such a way that only someone who really knows the universe is going to get it, I guess I owe it to them to give it another shot. So I will watch it next week and we'll see where we go from there. And again, if you if you are out there listening to this and you have very strong takes about The Stand, we want to hear about them.
Yes.
Definitely shoot your tweets at us. You can reach Rob at Rob Sesternino. You can reach me at Haymaker Hattie. We definitely want to know where you stand on The Stand and if we could stand to do another podcast or two. I think we might jump back in after episode 9 at least and give you a wrap up of the whole thing if I make it that far.
You tell us what you want, yeah. People, okay? And this is just that, I don't know if this is a hashtag or what, but should people write in, baby, can you dig this podcast?
Baby, can you dig your pod?
Baby, can you dig your pod? If you like this, and then if you don't, your tacit silence will mean, that's it, don't talk about this anymore.
Yeah, we will assume that, you know, your desire to watch this show has succumbed along with 99% of humanity.
You didn't say anything. That means you didn't want any more. Fine. Have it your way. We'll never talk about it ever again.
Yeah, we probably will talk about it in those...
Privately.
Yeah.
Well, I'll just call Jess. I don't have to record this.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same way that Josh and I frequently watch things that we podcast about together. One of us will watch it and we'll just live tweet it into the other one's text messages.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll
you don't
do
need
that.
To be part of this.
Yeah.
You don't want to. That you didn't say anything. That's fine.
Yeah, fine with me. I got a lot of other things I could be podcasting about.
Yeah, that's fine.
We know Rob has a lot of other things that he can be podcasting about. Although I do appreciate your rare jump over into the post-show recaps world, and it's like twice in about 3 weeks. So I feel like we're extra special because of that.
Yeah. Because I talked about Community.
Yeah. You dropped in on Community Building, which is a patron only podcast.
Yes. Patron only podcast. Okay. All right. I don't know. Maybe we should just do this for Post Recaps patrons. What about that?
Rob, they're a paying audience. I don't know if we should torture them. We might lose some patrons that way.
I don't know. Okay. Yeah. If I feel like that, if you're good and become Post Show Recaps patrons, maybe we'll do it. But I feel like that if enough people that it's like backwards logic. I can't wrap my head around it.
Hey, if we hit 1,000 patrons, I'll make Josh Wiggler podcast about the rest of this.
Sure. Okay. All right. Jess, I will also end this podcast with a revelation that I, not from the book of Revelations, but from the book of Rob Sesternino Revelations, that it's something that also like a repressed memory that came back to me as I watched this, that after I watched the 94 miniseries, then... I think I used to think about like films to make, and I felt like that I wanted to basically like film like almost like expanded Stand universe material of like that, you know, that I had like I didn't know who I was going to cast, but I felt like if I could get like two other people to sort of like reenact things, I could, that this would be like a good movie to have like other people from all around the, like, who else would be the survivors? What would their journey be like together?
So are you saying, Rob, that you were going to write fan fiction about The Stand?
Yes. I thought about it.
Okay.
About like, Jess, don't give me too much credit of being a writer. I think even then I was like, oh, I'll just get, if I had a video camera, I would think I would film like two people like acting like that this was like they were on their way.
Well, that's its own unique skill set, Rob. And, you know, if you want to feel slightly less lame about this, or maybe just feel like other people are as lame as you.
It's okay. Nobody's listening. All that's right. Fine.
Okay. Well, then I don't feel that ashamed if I only tell you that I wrote fan fiction about The Stand.
Yes. What happened in yours? Were you the main character?
No, I wasn't the main character. I don't write about myself, but it was more like, I can't even remember. It was a lot of pages. It was a lot. It was like original characters on their own journey and, sort of peripherally interacting with the other characters from the universe. And one of them was like, she thought she had the flu and then she didn't. And I don't know. It was dumb. It was super dumb, but I feel like everything that you write informs your skills as a content creator, even if it's not something that ever should see the light of day.
Okay.
I also wrote multiple college papers about The Stand. So there's that as well.
Whoa. Okay. All right. Well, I can't wait to hear more about that, but maybe I'm not going to do it on a podcast.
Yeah.
Okay?
Maybe we'll just hang out and talk about it sometime in the future when can hang out again.
All right.
Yeah.
Jess, do you have anything else about The Stand today?
I think I've just said it all.
Okay. We said it was too much.
That was a little bit of an overshare, wasn't it?
All right. Let me just give a quick edit note to Maddie, our editor. Maddie, so take like the middle section of this podcast, stick it right after I finish this up. Then take the starting around like 52 minutes to open the podcast with that.
Yeah, like put in the part where we talk about making our own interpretations of the story. Like put that
right,
because that happened first. So we should put that like second after we put the middle part in. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then also just go back to grab a piece of season 7, episode 2 of The Walking Dead recap and then grab me and Jess talking about that and then just stick that like anywhere in the middle.
Yeah, just wherever it looks pretty in the waveform.
No transition. Yeah. Just stick that right in. See if people can follow.
Yeah, that's all good.
And then we're going to do a coda on this podcast. Listen to it again next week. We're going to add in another 5 minutes at the end.
Yeah, I got to get Stephen King to finish writing that, though. I'm really worried about what he's got for us.
Yeah.
Might not be good. All right. But I think that takes us to the end of what we are going to do here today. Or is it the middle? Mm-hmm. I don't know anymore. So much, Rob, for dropping by Post-Show Recaps to entertain us with your takes on The Stand. And I am happy that we had the opportunity to discuss it. And maybe sometime in the future, we'll sit down and discuss it again. Or
okay.
Stand up and discuss
yes,
it
thank
again.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. Well, thank you, Rob. This has been a wonderful time for everybody. Please let us know what you think about it. Send us a comment or a tweet or however you feel like doing it. Come to us in a dream about corn. I don't know. Anyway, thanks everybody for listening. We'll see you again soon.